Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show today. I'm very excited to introduce my new friend, Ben Kabozi, who I met on Facebook, and which we were just talking about Facebook on my last interview, and a friend that I'd met on Twitter. And he's a gardener in Southwest Virginia who practices permaculture down there. He's kind of new to it, so he's going to share some of his new trials and successes and things, which I love to hear from people that are new because I think they kind of understand what other new people are going through. He's currently the planetarium guy at his local science museum, but he's also worked as a designer and an educator. I'm just happy to introduce my guest, Ben Kabozi. And Ben, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, gosh. Well, thanks so much for having me, Jackie. I've done a little bit of everything. I'm 40, and I have a lovely home with my wife and a couple great dogs here in South Boston, Virginia, in Virginia's Piedmont Zone 7B, USDA Hardiness Zone, which is very important. I've done a lot of different stuff. I've been an educator, and I still kind of keep a toe in that. I got my bachelor's in fine arts from Virginia Tech way back in 1995. I'm fairly new to gardening, and I absolutely love it. A day out of the garden is, it can be a decent day, but the really best days are when I'm out in the garden. Sure. Yeah. My address is in South Boston, Virginia, and this is where I live. And I've actually got a little bit of allergies going on right now, so hopefully I don't sound too bad.
Oh no, you sound great. So, what's your weather like? Like in Montana, we are having like the most amazing early spring. We started out with a hard winter, and it just melted. Like middle of February came, and it's been like spring. All the gardeners here are itching to get out, and they're gonna get out soon. I mean, I can't see it changing. The ice is gone, the snow is gone, and I know the East Coast is a little different, but what's it like where you are right now?
Well, today, believe it or not, yesterday it was 75, and today it's about 34.
Crazy.
crazy, yeah. It's cold and raining, and when I got off of work, I was all excited today to go out into the yard. I don't mind gardening in the rain when it's above, let's say, 50, but when it's below, you know, 40, I'm like, oh, it's a little chilly to be out here today. But yeah, it's been crazy weather. We had a pretty mild winter. The last week of February was sort of the big shock. We had about 8 inches of snow. And I wasn't here for that, so I missed it. Because if it's going to be cold, I would like to see snow. If it's just going to be cold and dreary and no snow, then I feel like that's a bad deal.
I'm like that, too. Although we had rain this weekend, and I kind of enjoyed, I finally got a little rest and stayed in and read a lot this weekend. So that was kind of nice. But usually I'm the same way. I'm like, I either want cold, snow, or sunshine.
Exactly.
Or if it's gonna be gray, at least if it rains, gray dreary kind of depresses me. But, and I'll just tell our listeners in case you're listening, it's March 19th when we're recording this, 2015. So, who knows when you'll be listening? The best thing about podcasts, you can listen anytime you want. So, Ben, tell us about your very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? Who were you with?
You know, growing things for myself, I don't think that happened until I was probably college age, so in my my early 20s. And I just had a little sort of, you know, a very modest kitchen garden on a small plot, a little strip outside of my apartment. But as a kid, I mean, growing up in the South, everybody had a garden. I mean, my neighbor had a garden, you know, big garden, you know, probably 100 feet deep by, you know, 100 feet wide, some of them. My aunts, my uncles, they all had gardens. And I think as a kid, I wasn't terribly interested in them. Certainly not the way I am now. I thought they were neat, though, but it didn't really grab me. It was really until a little bit later, I was in my 30s. And actually, one of the things when we started trying to grow more of our own food here in our yard, we live just off of Main Street in downtown South Boston. So it's a rural community, but I'm sort of in the urban part of it. And I can remember wanting to grow a bunch of things in our backyard. And we have a black walnut tree back there, which if you've dealt with those before, they secrete a toxic chemical, an allelopathic chemical that represses the growth of a lot of stuff. And often what people will say is, oh, you got a black walnut tree, nothing will grow under there. And kind of starting to figure out that, well, that's not actually true. Lots of stuff will grow under there. And then finding, of course, that there were other things where you could do raised beds. But it was really in my 30s when I really started getting into gardening. I guess I would say hardcore.
Cool. There's a lot of information just right there. So, did your parents have a garden? You said your aunts and uncles did.
My aunts and uncles did. I don't remember my parents having one. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, we actually moved into town in downtown Christiansburg, and I think that was the end of our garden days. Though it's funny now, both of my parents are in their 70s, and so they're like, "Oh, can you come help build us a garden? Because we'd really like to eat some
Nice.
more fresh food." So that's it's a nice opportunity for me to pay back a lot that they've given me.
And I think that's another important tip for people to hear, or another little tidbit that you weren't that into gardening when you were a kid, but now you really are, to encourage parents. Like, if your children aren't really that interested and they seem, because you're not the first one to say that, and I know I was like that when I was a kid. That just because your kids aren't necessarily showing any interest right then, or that maybe they're going to give you a little fight back, it's good to introduce them to it. It's good to keep going, and you never know when they get older how they're going to change and be, glad about those days and happy that they had those experiences, even if they give you a little, I don't want to type of thing.
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. And I think you and I both have a background in education. And one thing that I learned in the classroom is if you're enthusiastic about it, it's not too hard to get young people enthusiastic about it as well. And so I think especially with smaller children, if you can be like, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing. Come check this out. Look, it's starting to germinate, and then it's going to do this, and soon this will turn into a fruit or a flower, and here's what's happening." I mean, if you can come at it with a lot of passion and energy, I think that is something that really carries over, and I think kids will pick up on that enthusiasm.
You're absolutely right. That's very true. It's a lot of teaching is definitely being dramatic and bringing that
Yes.
enthusiasm to the table. Okay, so how about what does like earth gar organic gardening or earth friendly gardening mean to you?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. A basic definition for me, I think, would be gardening that you can do with your whole family and your pets present. So
Nice.
you're not sort of a massive aerial chemical attack on the things that you're trying to grow to eat and enjoy. But I mean, I think at a much deeper level, it involves, I think, really considering that the garden is not necessarily just a place that you extract things from. It's not just I'm going to put these things, I'm going to put these chemicals and nutrients into the ground, and it will produce these crops, and then I'll pull these out, and that's it. I think it's much more about building a relationship with the land and with the place you are. And I think that's really a really important part of the relationship of people to plants. And I think it's honestly where there's a lot of fun in and a certain degree of reverence, but I think it's almost sort of a first do no harm aspect to it, like the medical profession. I think it's just kind of approaching the land with, "Okay, well, I have this set of desires that I would like to, I have a yield that I'm interested in getting here. And then what seems reasonable? What can I grow?" And for me, with sort of a background in permaculture, a lot of it has to do with, well, can I set up beneficial relationships so that I can kind of work with nature to design a system that is going to give me a yield that I want without making the place where I'm working worse off, without adding any sort of toxins to the environment that I'm pulling my food in, and certainly to the food itself that I hope to enjoy.
Nice. I like that. That's just a great way to describe it. And I had another guest who talked about walking their dog, and there's all these little flags that the local landscapers put up on the little place that says, "Don't walk your dog here." It's only for a few days while they put the chemicals down or whatever, but still, like, do you really want to put that on your lawn and the rain's going to go into your groundwater?
Oh yeah, poor. If you ever rows of Sharon plants have a really dense fibrous root structure, and they're one of the things that I'm looking at putting as a border around part of my yard, because I have a neighbor who's a renter, and the landlord sends over a team of landscapers once a year, and they just kind of like napalm that part of the yard, and it kind of washes back into mine. So I'm sacrificing these rows of Sharon trees to kind of absorb things as a barrier layer.
And you know, that's something I've been thinking about a lot since I started this show is some kind of like education for the landscapers. And maybe we can get these landscapers on board somehow and they can start educating the people who are hiring them. Because they're the ones that actually put those chemicals out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the market is ready for that. I think that's a really good angle if you were to have a business on, you know, sustainable landscaping, any sort of thing that I think gets fewer chemicals in people's environment. Fewer, and, you know, everything is a chemical, but fewer, let's say, industrial chemicals into the environment. I think that people are receptive to it all across the country and all across the world. I think there is a real legitimate opportunity for folks who are interested in doing sustainable landscaping.
Nice. All right, listeners out there, somebody, it's time to get that going. So who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques, Ben?
It was when I wanted to do vegetables in the backyard and some of the, I guess I'll say like some of the old timers or whatever, like, oh, you're not gonna be able to grow anything back there. You got that black walnut tree. You should take it down. And I was like, oh no, that sounds like, well, that's awful. That, you know, it was like, that was just it. And all these people I thought, you know, knew an awful lot. And I was like, oh, okay. So I started poking around online and I started finding people like, no, not true. All kinds of stuff will grow there. And I was like, really? And that kind of got me into permaculture, because the place where I found most of the answers were on permaculture sites, like permies.com is a Paul Wheaton's site. It's sort of the biggest online community of permaculture goofballs. I think that's their tagline. But they were like, no, you can grow corn and different lettuces. And there's a couple things. Definitely don't grow these things. Do grow these things. Take out all your nightshades, but you can do onions and garlics and other things. And it just started to open up options and things where, well, that'll never work. You hear people say that, not just in the garden, but in all kinds of aspects of life. And permaculture for me seemed to be a community of people saying, well, it might work if, or it absolutely will work under these circumstances, or that might not work, but you could try this. And it just opened up a really cool world of possibilities. And there's tons of overlap with organics and permaculture and that sort of approach of working with natural systems.
Cool. I'll have to look that up. Okay, so how did you, so is that how you learned how to garden organically, basically, then, from?
I did two things. I joined the Master Gardeners here in Halifax County, Virginia. So I'm part of I'm a member of the Southside Virginia Master Gardeners, and that is a fantastic group. I love those people dearly. They're so supportive. Lots of them are sort of retirement age, but they love getting out in the dirt and they love sharing their knowledge, and it's a great group. So I did the 16 weeks of training with them to be a master gardener volunteer, and so that worked really well. And they actually sent me to Master Gardening College at Virginia Tech, my alma mater, last summer. Awesome. On a scholarship, so that was really nice. So I took copious notes at all those things, and then I just started going out in the yard and practicing, and at the same time I was doing my online permaculture design certificate and a couple other sort of web-based classes. So I'm fairly new to trying to do all this, let's say, with some training instead of just, oh, I'll stick this in the ground and, oh, it didn't grow. I wonder why. I tend to have a better idea now of about, well, this is why it didn't grow, or it's definitely not going to grow there, but it could grow here, especially if I plant it with this.
Yeah, but it sounds like you're really digging deep into getting yourself the knowledge, you're studying, you're reaching out and talking to people. Like, it sounds like it, even though it hasn't been that long, you've got quite a bit of knowledge already accumulated. So it's only going to grow.
I've certainly tried, yeah. Thanks. Well, you know, I mean, my career used to be, I like I said, I did a lot in education and graphic design, and I spent probably 10 to 15 years just kind of staring at screens, which at the time I thought was awesome. And
I know they're addicting, right?
Yeah, they are, and I'm not anti them. I still enjoy them quite a bit, but I've definitely shifted sort of the balance in my life from looking at pixels to looking at plants, and I find more enjoyment looking at the plants.
Nice. Well, so let's talk about last season. Tell us about something that grew well.
Oh my gosh. So last season, nasturtiums, which are little edible flowers. And actually they're sometimes they're little, sometimes they form these great sort of alien landscape mounds of these little disc-shaped petals. They're just gorgeous, and I use them a lot around the garden for soft borders, maybe along the sides of sidewalks or any garden paths, because you can kind of mow up against them and clip them up a bit, and no worries. But they're edible. The flowers are very spicy, and they're a great plant. I love them. I plant them around some of my fruit trees. They're mounding varieties, and then there are vining varieties. And I try to put the vining varieties out near the fruit trees and in the orchard to kind of be a nectary plant to draw sort of pollinators and things. But I love those. And a weird one that I did last year, it doesn't sound weird, but I used them in a weird way, was sweet potatoes. And I got it in my head that I was going to try and do this thing called a banana circle, which is a almost like a tropical technique for having like compost surrounded by bananas. Banana trees, banana plants are these really heavy feeders. And so if you have lots of things that that you kind of like to get rid of, you can have sort of your compost in the center and then ring it with banana trees, and then you can add things like sunchokes or Jerusalem artichokes, and sweet potatoes as a ground cover. That's where it came out of, this idea of sweet potatoes as a ground cover. And I was like, well, okay, that would be interesting. Let's try it. And they produce the most beautiful vines and flowers. And it's funny because literally at the end of the season, my wife was like, so are you going to collect the sweet potatoes? I was like, oh my God, I forgot. There's potatoes in there too. So I got the sweet potatoes. But sweet potatoes and nasturtium did very well here. Those are probably two of my favorite things. We planted a lot of perennial plants, lots of cane fruits and berry bushes. And last year was really an establishing year. I'm looking forward to them. I can already see the little bush cherry plants that we have out, the Nanking cherries. They've already got white flowers out already here. So I'm really excited about that.
Okay, so let me see if I can remember all of my questions. So I love
Sorry.
nasturtiums personally. They definitely have like a spicy, peppery
Yes.
type of flavor to add to salads, and they make them so pretty. And just, I love eating nasturtiums on my salads. But okay. So you said a mounding variety. Does that just mean you mean like a plant as compared to the vine type, or I just never
Yeah,
heard
there.
that term before. Maybe
I'd
just.
have to go back and look at the seed packs. We got probably six or seven different varieties of nasturtium between. We got some from Peaceful Valley Organic and some from Baker Creek Heirloom, and some of them twined up the fruit trees. And they did great, but others that we planted, they formed these mounds. I mean, they are sort of like a low ground cover, and they didn't sprawl, they didn't trail out, they just stayed kind of compact, maybe the size of say like half an ornamental boxwood or something. They were just these great little mounds, and I checked them, every day I'd go out, and they were right there off the corner of the porch, and they were wonderful. But yeah, it's a mounding variety. I'd have to look it up and tell you specifically which one it was.
Okay. And then, all right, so sweet potatoes with a banana circle. And when you first said that, I was thinking, because my mom was talking when I interviewed her about cutting up the banana peels and using, she puts it like in the blender, I think, and using
Yes.
that as like a compost. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about actual banana plants?
Yeah, actual banana plants.
Do
And
they grow bananas?
no, what I do is I do a Japanese, there's a Japanese variety, a winter hardy variety that's actually hardy down to like a little bit below zero, but it's still a heavy feeder and it gives sort of a tropical look to the yard. So we planted them. And they just eat tons and tons of stuff. They don't produce an edible banana,
Okay.
but honestly, it was a way for us sorry, that's my dog here in the background. Sorry about that.
No worries.
But it's honestly a way for us to handle disposing pet waste.
I just missed your,
Okay.
what did you say? Now it disposes of your pet
Yes,
waste?
it's a great way of disposing of pet waste because these
You
banana
did
plants
say
that we're
that.
using don't produce an edible banana. But like all banana plants, they're really heavy feeders. They pull lots and lots of stuff. They need lots and lots of stuff to grow, and our dogs are constantly producing things. So we basically work with the plant in order to dispose of a lot of that stuff because it's not producing anything that we're going to eat.
Wow,
Yeah, it's
that's
weird.
awesome. So, like, you can just—I mean, this might sound gross, but I mean, that's actually like, so you're saying you can like bury the dog poop in the yard and the banana plants will like turn it into dirt?
We do. We
Instead
do,
of
yeah,
having to throw it in the garbage?
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's the thing, trying to find a system where we don't have to just, you know, put it in a baggie and then send it off to the landfill.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, what a great thing for people. I hope people try that and look into that. We live in the woods, so our dogs kind of just, they're free to run. And we have 20 acres. There's not much of a problem except in the winter. But
oh my gosh, 20 acres. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So, all right. How about something you would do different next year or you want to try new next year? I know you have a lot on your plate.
Yeah. We're always kind of doing some weird things here in the yard, but we did straw bales last year, at least in part of ours. We were redesigning our raised garden bed, so we did straw bales instead, and straw bales worked really, really well. We did that for our tomatoes and broccoli and cabbage, and it was great. It really did sort of turn into kind of a set it and forget it, where we had to do less watering, and it worked out really, really well. So I think this year we're going to try and do more of that. We have a bunch of new perennials that we're trying this year. I'm adding a lot more strawberries to the yard. Wild strawberries grow as like a low ground cover, sort of all over different corners of our yard. So I looked at that as a cue to say that, well, maybe some cultivated strawberries would do well here. And so we planted some a couple years ago and then pinched all the blossoms that first year so that they would force them to put down good roots. And then last summer we had like 6 weeks of strawberries. It was wonderful. I mean, it was like something in Little House on the Prairie. My wife would go out into the yard and she would come back with, you know, an apron full of strawberries, and they were great and they were fresh. So this year I was like, let's double down on strawberries. So we're adding a ton more strawberry plants just all over the yard in little corners where we can.
Nice. And, you know, I was thinking about, aren't strawberries like one of the foods that, like, if you're going to pick organic foods, if you can only pick one or two, like strawberries should be at the top of your list because it absorbs. I'll have to look into that, but I'm pretty sure organic strawberries are, like, if you can get those, they're pretty prime.
Yeah, I mean, they're, for us, you know, we don't do any sort of treatment on them, but I mean, really, you can get 25 strawberry plants for, you know, less than $10 at a couple of different places. And that's, you know, if I go to the grocery store and I see, you know, they've got these quart containers, you know, two for $4. You know, that's good for a day or two's eating, but for that same price, I could invest that in starting to grow, you know, a perennial crop of strawberries here in the yard. And that turns into better economics for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like you said, that's nice. So I just always like to tell our listeners, you know, perennials are things that come back every year. Annuals are things that you have to plant again every year. So as he's saying, you know, you put that perennial in and you'll get strawberries for like a lifetime, or maybe, I mean, you might have to replace some eventually, but they spread and they grow. And yeah, strawberries are
absolutely
wonderful that way.
And they become a great plant for making friends or for retaining friendships, because they'll put out those runners. And if they're growing where you don't want them to grow, you can clip those runners and pot them up and then gift them to friends and family.
Yes. What a great, I mean, that I, one of my guests that's going to be on, I think next week, that I already did the interview with, he has been in our community with a nursery for a long time. And that's what they've done, is shared a lot of their irises and different perennials that were overflowing. And so our whole community has benefited from that. And I know a lot of their irises and different perennials like that are growing in our garden, thanks to them. Lilacs. Yeah. I always get lilacs and lavender. I have to think, but yeah, tons of lilacs from them too. Okay. So tell me about something that didn't work so well this last year.
Oh, what didn't work so well? I had a small bare root almond tree that failed, and that made me very sad. I'm not quite sure what happened with it though. This year I'm trying it again, so I've actually got a couple more almond trees, so we're gonna try it again in different places in the yard. Actually, I'm kind of embarrassed, but one thing that didn't work well was radishes. And I'm not sure what I did wrong, because you really have to work at it, I feel, to have a radish that fails to thrive. But I planted a bunch of these little Easter egg radishes, and I did them in the straw bales, and maybe the topsoil dried out. I'm not quite sure exactly what happened, but I didn't get a one from them, and that made me very sad.
You know, you're actually the second person on my show to say that. And these other people were big gardeners, and they just had a bad radish season this year. They were surprised. But they said that they eat the pods anyway, which I wish after when I was listening to the replay, I was like, I should have dug a little deeper on that. Like eating the pods, I never heard of that.
Oh, like when they germinate, just like the almost like microgreens. Maybe.
I guess. I don't know. I was thinking, like, are the pods, like, isn't that where the seeds are going to be then? Right. You know, radishes can be tricky. I mean, I know they grow really well, but then, you know, you always have bugs to deal with, and they bolt so easily, and, you know. They're just, you know, you get them to come up early, and they're fast, and they're, I think, always good for kids to see, but. You know, actually getting good radishes out of them isn't always the easiest thing.
I'll tell you one thing that's definitely a non-traditional, but it was not my idea. I read it in a book by Toby Hemenway called Gaia's Garden, which is a great book on if you decide you want to maybe do more perennials. But he talks about a technique for loosening up really hard soil. And it's basically planting daikon radish. And if you're familiar with daikon, you know it puts out a taproot that's like the size of your forearm. I mean, it's a long 12, 14, 18-inch root in some cases. And it's a Japanese-type radish. It's really considered like, oh, primo, daikon. But you can, you know, get several pounds of seed for, you know, $10 or something. But he talked about planting it where you have maybe heavy soil, heavy clay soil. And let it just completely do its thing. And when it's after it's done flowering, and it produces beautiful purple flowers. But after it's done, you just kind of chop it where it stands and let it mulch itself, basically. And you leave the roots in the ground. And as they decay, they provide food for worms and all kinds of other soil life, but they aerate the soil. And so you basically plant these roots that are going to do all the plowing for you. And I did that for several seasons where we eventually wound up putting our orchard of fruit trees. And I can see where that soil has changed. It was extremely compact and it's getting better. So we didn't eat any of those daikon. Like I said, we left them in the ground. But I love radishes. So this year I'm looking forward to actually growing some that we can eat.
Nice. Those are just tons of cool tips there. And I didn't know that. I just saw daikon radishes in the store the other day and was looking at them. And
they're delicious, very spicy.
Cool.
Like, you know, like a good radish, yeah.
And what a great way to work on your soil like that and loosen it up and just, you know, adding, I love that whole part, kind of like what you were saying in the beginning about, you know, having your relationship with the soil and the earth. So that's just a great example.
It requires some patience.
Well, gardening definitely does. I mean, I do not have quite the patience for it. If it was me by myself. But my husband, he's got enough patience for both of us, so we're good. All right. Something that you find is easy to grow and is generally successful every time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we haven't had any of those nasturtiums. You know, it's boring, but we eat a lot of it. So I'm going to say lettuces. Mm-hmm. And we grow like Simpson. Mm-hmm. We've got these little Tom Thumb, little sort of like micro lettuce. They're adorable. They're like smaller than your fist. Like that's the little head that they form. They're wonderful. It's like a dwarf lettuce. They're these little tennis ball lettuces that, again, the little lettuce head is like sort of the size of a tennis ball. We tend to do lots of lettuces. I mean, we lived the first year we really started gardening out of a couple pots with, I think we had some romaine and we had several of the Simpson black seeded lettuce. And I cannot tell you how many times we would go out there. You know, if you have enough of them, you can do that cut and come again, where basically you harvest several leaves off and then you leave that plant alone for, say, you know, the better part of a week or longer, depending on the variety. And there will be fresh leaves and you just kind of rotate between your garden plots, or if you're doing it all out of pots. But I mean, we had fresh greens, fresh salads. And for me, if you buy fresh greens, and I think lots of our friends we've talked with have this problem too, if you buy greens at the store, in, say, the plastic container, how many times have you had maybe a salad or two that first night, and then very quickly they've started to turn slimy, and you're like, I don't really want salad tonight because the lettuce doesn't look good. I mean, a great thing
And it
about
happens
growing
to
your
me
own
all
food
the
is,
time.
yes, it does, doesn't it? So,
Yes.
I mean, if you've got it in a pot right outside your
And
kitchen
they're
door,
expensive, those containers.
they are. I mean, a pack of lettuce seed is like $3, and that's like 300 seeds. I mean, you
I
can
know.
grow a lot of lettuce on the cheap.
I just actually finally found the pictures of every year almost we grow a big peace sign full of lettuce. And we use, I was thinking I should have put in there that we use that black seeded Simpson has worked the
Yes.
best for me for it. And it's just kind of like that. And I just, I'll go around the left side one day and pick those outer leads off of that side. And then, a couple of days later, I go around to the, and by the time I get around the whole circle or do the inside leaves, it's back to the other side. And I cannot keep, but that's worked the best for me, having it in that circle like that. I've tried it other ways and rows and different places, but that circle of lettuce just goes. And I was reading in my journal that one year it went all the way through the whole hot of August into September. I was still getting salads out of it.
Oh wow,
But
that
yeah.
it is a real workhorse in the garden. I think it's a great variety, and if you look at, say, like Seed Savers Exchange or some of the others, they'll list lots of different varieties, and they'll say slow to bolt, or really stands up to the heat. There's actually it's re I don't think it's technically a spinach, but it has a spinach-like consistency, and it's called Malabar spinach, and it's a really a prolific vine that has that sort of spinachy taste and texture, and it loves the heat. So if you want to do, say, on the shoulders of summer, so in late spring you can get some spinach, and then in late summer, early fall, you can get plenty more spinach. But if you want that spinach kind of thing in the summer and you live where it's extremely hot, try that Malabar spinach. It's a vine, but it takes a beating in the heat, and it gets We have a few days here in our part of Virginia where it's at least 100.
Yeah, I mean, even here in Montana, we get our hot spells. It cools down at night, thank God, but we're still, we're not ready for air conditioning yet,
we
but
don't get that. It still stays hot.
we're pretty good here. But things definitely bolt. July comes and it's hot in the garden. Okay, how about
Absolutely.
something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
What would I say? I'm not sure I can think. Be careful. I don't know exactly what a specific variety that I'm thinking of, but I think that it's important maybe if you're a new gardener to pay attention to, is it something that, say, think about planting it and think about when it's going to be at the harvest stage. And if it's, say, something like cabbage or broccoli or something that really prefers cooler weather, make sure you either start with starts, say already from a greenhouse or a nursery where the plants are already 5 to 6 inches tall, and you start with those in the spring so that you can kind of get your harvest if possible before the real heat of summer comes on. Because lots of the people, oh, I'm putting down cabbages or something, and it's already 90 degrees or something, and that's just going to put the hurt on that plant. At least that's been my experience. So I
And
can't think
even
of
a
a
lot of lettuce and
yeah.
radishes are that way too.
Oh gosh,
Yeah.
absolutely, absolutely.
I
Radishes, I
think
mean,
that's
radish
great
are
in like.
cold season. And I mean, the cool thing about those is if you really like those, then you've already got your fall garden planned. Lots of people think that, well, I'm going to grow annuals and I can only get them in the summer. Oh my gosh. When fall rolls around, all kinds of additional stuff, especially those cabbage family things, those brassicas, broccolis, and there's so many cool varieties, all kinds of different colors, way more than you see typically in the grocery store. I mean, I remember I did a tour of the gardens at Monticello one year, and the lady was talking about Thomas Jefferson planted lettuce every day from like February to November. I mean, there were just a few months where he was not planting seeds somewhere and getting a crop. So there's lots of annuals that if you sort of continue to sow, this week I sowed here, and the next week I moved over to here and I sowed some more, you can just get your whole yard going in rotation, and there can always be something for you to be harvesting if you have the room. It's wonderful.
And that's such a key too, that when you rotate your harvest, like then you don't have such a huge giant thing of everything coming up all at once.
Kind of spread
It's
it
hard
out.
to
It's
do. To me, it's very hard to do, but
interesting. There's a brilliant orchardist up in Canada who has he has a you know a pick your own operation, and he's designed it like the aisles of a grocery store where he's picked varieties of fruit trees that so everything in row one is in season and ready to harvest, say the 4th week of July. And then the 1st week of August, you move to another row, and they're all varieties of apple and pear and peach and plum that
nice.
are in season that. So he's designed his operation to actually get 6 months of production, and guests can come, and there's always something in harvest. And it's his name is Stefan Subkowiak, and he's brilliant up in Canada. But the idea of organizing your garden like that is it's wonderful.
Cool. Okay. So, how about your least favorite activity to do in the garden?
Watching something die.
Oh, nice. Oh, I know, it's
Watching.
heartbreaking, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially we try to grow lots of perennials, and so to see something that you've invested in or something, especially if it's maybe two years on, and then it's starting to decline and you can't quite figure it out. I mean, I think lots of people would say weeding, but one thing that I've certainly got from permaculture is the idea of really looking at weeds and trying to read the weeds, try to see what they're telling you. So based on their root structure, say something like dandelions have a deep taproot, kind of like what I was talking about, that daikon radish, and they do really well in compacted soil. And dandelions, where you see them, you know that that soil is compacted. Same thing with other things like chickweed or other weeds that have, say, a really fibrous root structure. They're usually somewhere where they're trying to hold the soil together. Maybe it's an area where there's a lot of erosion. And so you don't necessarily have to leave these weeds, though both of those are edible weeds, but you can say, okay, well, if this is telling me that I've got an erosion problem, or dandelions are really thriving here, and I know that they tend to do best when the soil is really compacted, if I could break up this soil, I could then start to cultivate maybe something that's a lot closer to what I'm interested in. So I guess when I think about weeds, I'm like, okay, what is this weed trying to tell me? Because it's here for a reason, and it's doing well because the conditions are right for it. So how do I make the conditions right for something else that I would like to put in there? And you talked about your husband, and you were talking about clover as a cover crop. Planting clover for us has been one of the best ways to manage weeds. If you have bare earth, nature will find a way to cover it. It doesn't really like bare earth. So we try to pick a cover crop before nature kind of self-selects one that would do best there. So clover is great for shading out things. You can interplant clover in all your beds. It's not going to drown out or choke out any of your annual vegetables. If anything, it's going to make them much happier.
Nice. You're just full of tons of information today. All right. How about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
I like going out and checking on it every day. I really do. It's a morning ritual. I take my cup of coffee with me and I go out there and I look at everything. I just like watching the cycles. Since I started gardening, I've become much more aware of the wildlife that exists in my yard, even in the middle of downtown. I've seen little garden snakes. I've seen a frog. I've started to be able to identify different birds. And I think coming from a couple jobs that were maybe more high stress or sort of maybe more corporate, it's a very interesting change of pace to just go out and kind of be in the garden, just to kind of observe and see, oh, well, this has changed and what's going on here. And it's very satisfying to have an idea that, well, I'm going to plant, I have this idea to put these things here and I think they'll do well. And then to see them do well, I mean, to see an idea. You can learn a lot, by plants just in one season. I had this idea, I tried it, oh, it worked. That's really cool. It's very satisfying.
Nice. And you know what I was thinking about, our last little question was that you have a lot of positive solutions to problems. I like that part. You know, like
Yeah,
about
and I
talking about the dandelions, where most people will be like, "Well, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to go spray my Roundup." Whereas you're looking at it from a totally different angle and coming up with a solution and positive different changes we can make. So
I mean, that's something that I found in the organic and certainly in the permaculture community. A lot of it is really just maybe kind of paying attention in a different way and saying, well, yes, that is one solution, but are there others? I mean, I remember one time in the Master Gardener class. I love that class and I love those people, but on our pesticides use class, you know, it's basically me and a bunch of you know, sort of retired citizens, and to watch the presentation on putting on basically a biohazard suit to go out and prepare, you know, if you want to have an apple tree or a peach tree, there's a point where you can kind of step away from it and say, gosh, this seems kind of ridiculous. This is a lot of work. I mean, have people always done this? I mean, it's an apple tree. Doesn't it want to grow? Doesn't it want to be an apple? And so the idea of working without a lot of those, I think, is extremely appealing. And it just seems way more natural and way more enjoyable. You know, I don't think a lot of people want to, you know, don a biohazard suit to be part of their gardening. And it certainly doesn't have to be.
Mm-mm. Maybe we need to start like a permaculture organic master gardening class.
Oh, that would be great. That would be fabulous. Actually, I think I've heard that Montana has a pretty progressive master gardening. You know, they're all, I think, organized by the land grant university in each state or in each community.
And I think ours comes out of Montana State University in Bozeman, the Extension Service.
Oh, fantastic. So, fantastic.
It wouldn't surprise me. Montanans have always been pretty progressive. I know.
You guys have a lot of just gorgeous, gorgeous scenery, and it's great that you appreciate it.
Yep. Well, we're all rich because we get to live here.
That's that is very true.
Okay, how about a favorite tool you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Pitchfork.
Yep.
Pitchfork, because it's the easiest way to turn compost. Mm-hmm. And in a pinch, it maybe could double as a pseudo shovel. It'd be between my pitchfork and my shovel.
Uh-huh. My husband and I were talking about this last night, and I was saying his first answer to the question was his long-handled shovel. And that was my first gut reaction. But then I was thinking, you know, I think I'd pick my wheelbarrow because for one, a shovel is a lot cheaper to replace. If I move somewhere, I can buy that shovel. The practical part of me. And I don't know, maybe because our wheelbarrow like got a flat a few years ago that we couldn't replace, and it took me a long time to get a new one. But I wouldn't want to live without that wheelbarrow, I'll tell you that. And I don't know, I was like, you know, I could make a shovel out of cardboard, or there's, you know, I can dig with, the, you know, most of his dirt where the beds already are, you can practically dig with your hands a lot of it. I know he was just kind of laughing because he's been digging a new bed, and so there's tons of rocks, and there's no way he could be where he is right now without a big heavy duty shovel. But a pitchfork was definitely one of my runner ups for flipping the compost and stuff. And I thought that too. I was like, a pitchfork could, you know, you could use that for a shovel in places. Cool. So how about tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Cause that's a tough one for me. Like the lettuce, you know, I do pretty good with, but lots of other things I have a hard time. And even the lettuce, like I'll pick it, but then dinner's ready and I don't even get to wash it or eat it that day. And then the next day, maybe I wash it. And by the third day, I'm finally eating it. And it's time to pick new stuff again for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of that, at least for us, is planting things that we like. You know, there are a couple things we won't plant the obligatory, say, you know, patty pan squash or something, because we don't really enjoy those. Mm-hmm. They're fine, but they're just kind of neutral. So we won't plant those. But most of what we do is, I would say, just try and plant things that you know you want and try and plant them close to your house. And close to your kitchen. Some folks put the garden, you know, way out in the South 40. But for us, we've tried to tuck things almost like you can't get into the house without seeing them. So if they're doing poorly, you're kind of ashamed, you know, as you enter, you're like, oh, my God, that plant needs me. And if they're doing really well, they just look so perfect. You're like, oh, my gosh, I know what we're doing for dinner tonight. We're going to do this. That placement of your garden has helped us a lot, and picking things that you know you just can't wait to eat.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think convenience has to be a part of it. And I always wanted like what I call like my kitchen garden, like a salad garden right outside my kitchen door that just has like the radishes and the cherry tomatoes and like just the last minute things for just throwing a quick salad together when dinner's ready. And then, you know, the carrots and the you know, all the big stuff can be down in the big garden, but you have to walk up. Our garden's kind of downhill. I mean, it's not a big hill, but you know, when dinner's like, I don't know why salad sometimes is an afterthought to me, and I'm like putting the plates on the table. I'm like, oh yeah, I was gonna make a salad. Let me run down. Or a lot of times, yeah, Mike will run down and grab me radishes or something to put on it. But
I think
convenience is key for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, all right, how about secrets for preserving food or making it last? Do you do any canning or freezing or any,
you know,
kind of thing? Dehydrating?
We don't, but we're hoping to this year. I'd like to take a class on canning. I'd like to actually know how to do it. Might not even need a class. I'm sure we have some friends here that we could just kind of observe, but we don't have experience with that. We have done some dehydration of some of the potatoes and things like that, but I would like to learn a lot more about that because I think it's incredibly useful. And I can remember eating food that had been canned by my grandmother when I was a kid, and at the time, of course, I had no appreciation. Oh, we've got tomatoes in, you know, January for fresh pasta sauce. That's really cool. But as a kid, I don't think I appreciated it. But now I'm like, oh my God, I would kill for some of those tomatoes we had this summer. You know, it's a very valuable skill.
And there's nothing like taking something out in the middle of winter, like a jar of pickles, or I always talk about Mike makes pickled beets. And like, so I don't even think about putting tomatoes on my salad because I just put beets on them all winter long.
Oh, my gosh, kinda, it sounds wonderful.
It's a different flavor, but it just kind of replaces that. I just can't buy a tomato at the store to put on a salad. They just are too hard and flavorless. And
absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be one of the biggest reasons to have your own garden. I mean, just for taste. I mean, so much of the vegetables that we eat have been cultivated for their ability to travel in the back of a truck for thousands of miles. You know, it's much better to have a tomato that, you know, is bruised just when you pick it, but you only need to carry it 20 feet into your house to have a delicious sandwich. It's really great. Mm-hmm.
The health food store in our town, that was their motto. It's all about the taste.
That's wonderful.
Foods. Yeah. Okay. How about any special techniques for cooking, like any kind of weird or unusual foods?
For picking them, I can't think of anything right now. It's not unusual, but I talked about just briefly the strawberries. If you decide that you'd like to grow them, you may or may not know, but that first year you plant them, make sure that when they start to produce flowers and buds, go ahead and pick those off, because that will force them to really focus on building roots that first year, and you will have a much better crop and a much healthier strawberry plant that second year. If you do that, it's just kind of your time to plant. Don't worry about reproduction. You know, don't put any effort into that. It's not stressful. Just work on, you know, building your strength for next year. And then they'll put out so many more flowers and so much more fruit.
Cool. How about cooking, like any kind of weird or unusual foods?
Yeah, you know what? We have an herb garden pretty much right outside our kitchen. And we've always grown chives. And we would just kind of, you know, throw them into salads and things. And I was at a vegetarian restaurant this summer, and they had a breakfast dish they called savory oats. And I was like, what is that? Because I'm used to having, you know, say a banana and walnuts or maple syrup in my oatmeal. And it was oatmeal with chives and soy sauce. And if you're a vegan or vegetarian, you might be familiar with nutritional yeast flakes, which is sort of a salty, cheesy, you know, really delicious thing. And it was basically hot oats with chives, soy sauce, and those nutritional yeast flakes. And I was like, I've never had oats that are not sweet, but I had it, and it has become a staple in our house for breakfast. And I love just going out, grabbing a handful of chives and chopping them right up and cooking everything. Savory oats is maybe something that people haven't thought of before.
Nice. I'm going to try that. That sounds good. I love your nutritional yeast. Do you use that? Oh, what's that stuff called? The doctor.
Yes. Is it Bragg's?
That's
liquid
what we,
amino?
Yeah. That's what we put on popcorn with nutritional yeast.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so good. Have you not tried that?
No, we haven't bought Bragg's in a while. We live in such a rural community. It's hard to find things like Bragg's. But every now and then we'll travel down to like Durham or Raleigh, and there's a Whole Foods down there. We have a lot more variety.
We have, I think they sell that right at our grocery store here in Eureka.
Really?
Certainly, it's definitely at the health food store, but I would be surprised if it wasn't. We're pretty lucky up here, I guess. Lots of hippies. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
You know, that year that we had so much lettuce from the Simpsons Black Headed, we did a cool salad with that Simpsons lettuce, rice, just a block of tofu cut up into, you know, sort of regular tofu, you know, decent cube chunks. And we would put a sort of a Thai peanut sauce on that, you know, like peanut butter, maple syrup, and a little bit of soy sauce. And that was actually amazing. It was delicious. And it was great to have when it was like 90 degrees or hotter outside. You know, the idea of like, ooh, cold tofu, I don't know if I would like that, but it wound up being perfect. A little bit of a crushed red pepper, and it was great. And that, you know, we'd see that lettuce and we'd start to already salivate. Say, oh, let's make one of those salads today.
I eat lots of cold tofu, like tofu salads. With
As
long as
great.
You like marinate it, I think, or put in like some good salad dressing with it. I don't know. How about a favorite internet resource?
Oh, gosh. I use permies.com a lot, permaculturenews.org. Anything by a guy named Jeff Lawton is always inspirational. It's Jeff, G-E-O-F-F. Sorry, G-E-O-F-F. He's an Australian who's sort of a modern leader in permaculture, and everything he puts out is very inspirational. It's all very positive. It's all, here's how you can do things. Here's how things that are very abundant, and all his resources are free. That's pretty much daily inspiration watching, you know, what he's doing next. And he puts out new videos every week and they're just like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever. I picked up a lot of garden ideas from him. Just like, oh, I'm going to see if I can try that here.
Nice. Those Australians are really on top of things, aren't they?
I know.
Not only are they ahead of us in the time zone, but they're like at the forefront of like, you see them everywhere. You see them on Instagram. You see them on Twitter. You see them like they're just on it. And they were always like, you always heard about them in education. I don't know. I mean, Australians and New Zealanders, you always heard of them at the forefront of the education.
I think so. And I think just certainly from at least the garden perspective, I think they're already experiencing a lot of effects from climate change, having to deal with scarce water and some other things. And I think part of that is fueling a lot of their innovation and a lot of their passion for working on solutions. I think just some really impressive stuff is coming out of there.
Nice. How about a favorite reading material or like a book or a magazine or blog or something?
Anything by Toby Hemingway. He wrote that Gaia's Garden, and I think he has a new site out. I think it's called Pattern Recognition, but it's a lot about looking at natural systems and seeing them. You know, it's a weird resource. It's never anything that I thought I would listen to, but there's a show called The Survival Podcast, hosted by a guy named Jack Spirko, and it deals with a lot of gardening. There's a lot of non-gardening stuff in there that wasn't really my bag, but he has a lot of really interesting and powerful things to say about growing your own food and the merits and the rewards of that. And I actually enjoy his show quite a bit, more than I thought I would.
Cool. I'll have to check him out. I think I might have saw him on Twitter just the other day, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, he's got a pretty big show, yeah. He's a neat character.
Cool. All right. So my next question is about if you have a business. Now, have you just started a permaculture business? Is that what I'm understanding? Like, I didn't
see a
website or anything.
No, I kind of chronicle, you know, what's going on in my garden just for my own amusement on a site. I have a blog called themainstreetgardener.com, but I do not have a permaculture business. I think I'm still in that position where I'm trying to figure out what I might do and what may be possible. My wife's family has a lot of farm property that I think they're not quite sure what to do with. I think that's, I'm hoping that there's a permaculture business in my future, but right now I don't have one.
Cool. Well, maybe when I'm up to episode like 200, we'll have you back on as our as a new business guest.
Oh, that would be fantastic. I would love that.
Cool. All right, then here's my final question. If there was one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? Like, is there a charity or an organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet, you know, in regards to the environment or the earth, either in your local area or like on a national or global scale? Like, what's your big green passion?
Based on what I've read and what I've looked into, you know, we talked a little bit before. I mean, I'm vegan, and I feel like that's movement in the right direction. But I think learning about plants as much as I have, and learning about the beneficial relationship between plants and animals, gardening has helped maybe evolve my thinking even more. And I am pretty convinced that the best thing people could do is to encourage a shift towards perennial crops instead of annual crops. The idea of developing, there's a great book written in the 20s, and I'm forgetting the name of the author, but it's called Tree Crops. And it was by a gentleman, I believe he was working with the USDA or some branch of the government at the time, but he was already starting to look at sort of the four signs of the Dust Bowl, the erosion, the loss of soil, the degradation of the natural world. And a lot of it had to do with our shift towards, let's say, a modern agricultural production system where we plow these fields and we plant these annuals and we keep these fields, you know, bare, or basically a very artificial environment for 3 out of 4 seasons in order to get one crop of, say, corn or soybeans over the summer for a few months. That has a lot of really deleterious environmental effects. And he, at that time, was already talking about, why are we not planting, say, chestnut trees or walnuts or these other nut trees or other perennial crops where these plants want to live a long time and they want to have a very long productive life. It's not the idea that we should all be eating chestnuts and acorns. I'm certainly not saying that. I'm saying that many of the industrial food products that we get, lots of our oils, lots of things that are derived from corn, could be derived not from an annual plant like Zea maize, but could be derived from chestnuts, walnuts, from apple trees, peach trees, all kinds of other perennial crops. And I think that if we all move more towards eating perennial foods, they could absolutely help improve everything. I honestly believe that, from our health to the health of the planet. And that is not my idea. That is the work of a great guy. Actually, I believe he's working in either Wisconsin or Montana. I think it may be Wisconsin. His name is Mark Shepard, and he has a great book called Restoration Agriculture that's all about how to do that. And he has I think it's about a 200-acre commercial farm with mostly perennials, and he is doing it. He's not just talking about it. He's doing it. And I think he's like member number 22, I think, in one of the largest organic co-ops in the nation, and I can't remember the name of it, but he was very early into that organization. So if you're into organic and you're into better food and better health for everyone, you should really check out his work.
Cool. Wow. You're just full of tons of information. So I've got two questions for you. You going to say anything about hemp and cannabis then? Do you have any little tidbits there?
You know, the little bit that, this is going to sound coy, the little bit that I know about it, but I believe that there is research, I haven't read it, but I'm pretty sure there's lots of research to say that tons of products can be derived from these plants. And the idea that, to me, the idea that someone's life can be ruined for the possession of a plant and what they do with it, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I think it's time and money not well spent. So I guess that's my 2 cents on it.
And then how about anything about being a vegan?
I think that there are lots and lots of merits. I have I have heart disease, which is why, excuse me, I changed my diet to a vegan diet.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, have you always been a vegan, or how do you get?
Yeah, no. At 36, I had like a 60-70% blockage of one of my major coronary arteries, and they wanted to put in a stent. And I said, well, no, I'll take some medication, but let's not do a stent. So I changed my diet, and it was essentially a vegan diet modified with the elimination of a lot of oil. And that's honestly helped me reverse my heart disease quite a bit. I myself don't eat animals, and I try to avoid the use of any animal products as much as I can. But I'm not one of those, I hate to say, crazy vegans, but to a certain extent, some people are, you know, murderer, you know, you ate a McDonald's chicken McNugget, you're worse than Hitler. I don't really feel, you know, Hitler was a vegetarian, so I mean, I don't know if you're in the best company, but I'm not like that. I just try to live in a way that that is pleasing to me without harming other folks. But I do think that there is an awful lot of merit in the work of folks who are talking about the value of grazing animals. If you look at the work of Alan Savory, if you look at even folks who are doing organic pasture-raised animals, if you look at Joel Salatin here in Virginia, who's an amazing farmer, these people are doing work with animals. I would say that the animals have much better quality of life, infinitely better quality of life than in any sort of factory farmed operation, which I think it's pretty hard to argue is not an inhumane system. But there are guys who are proving that you can do it a different way and be profitable and take really good care of the animals. I myself hope to someday have a farm where I can have animals. I wouldn't raise them for slaughter. I just don't have it in me to be the guy, you know, I mean, at the end, like, oh, I hope you've enjoyed your time with me. Now it's time for me to take you into this room and, you know, off to the abattoir. That doesn't work for me, but I don't really have a lot of hostility towards people who do that. In fact, I have a lot more respect for people who know where their food comes from, who know who their farmer is. And I know that they've taken pretty good care of that animal up until its, you know, its final days.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What about, can I just add, like, is your wife a vegan too? Or
she's mostly vegan. She goes, she's been extremely supportive, I guess. Let me say that. I mean, the day that we had my diagnosis and I was like, I think I'm going to try this other thing. She was on the phone with me and I mean, she was, I'm throwing this out of the refrigerator and I'm throwing this away. I mean, nice. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. A large part of why I'm still alive is thanks to her. But yeah, she's kind of a modified. Occasionally she will have fish and occasionally an egg. We don't force our diet onto our dogs, though they do love a ton of vegetables.
Nice. Cool. Well, good. All right. So just I like to leave off with like an inspirational tip or any kind of a quote to help motivate our listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden.
I'll tell you what. There's a great proverb about and I think Jack Spirko talks about this, that, you know, a society is great when old men plant trees under which whose shade they will never sit. The idea of kind of paying it forward, doing things that go beyond maybe just your immediate family's benefit or even beyond your generation's benefit. I think there's a great need for that kind of thinking. And a great piece of advice one master gardener gave me one time was, she said, you know, plants are a lot like kids. The more you baby them, the more babying they need. And I've definitely used that in the garden. Like, do I wrap these tonight? Do I not wrap them? Do I, you know, do I really over fret and worry about this plant? Or do I let it see if it can tough it out? And that's taken a lot of guilt off my conscience.
Cool. Does that seem to work too? Like, if you don't baby them, they grow pretty good.
It makes
them hardier or something.
I think some of them. I think what it does, and actually Mark Shepard talks about this, it kind of helps the plants self-select for maybe the ones that are going to do their best where you are. There are some plants that to get them to grow where you are, the conditions may not be right, and they just require a lot more babying, and you may not be into that. And so if they keep dying, at some point, perhaps it will motivate you to say, well, let me find something hardier. Let me find something that's a better fit. This is one of the reasons why I don't really do a greenhouse. I feel like a greenhouse requires so much work. And there are people much more clever than me who actually would probably say that a greenhouse is not that hard. And my hat's off to them. But for me, for the level of effort that I like to put into the garden, I like to set the plants up for success and hopefully they don't require too much intervention.
That's interesting. You know, like in our climate, I mean, it's pretty much essential. You know, a lot of things you're just not going to grow if you don't have, if you don't extend your season with like a greenhouse in the spring and mm-hmm. plastic covers in the fall. And I kind of think like, you know, you have to let kids, you know, have a lot of free reign, but they also do need a certain amount of nurturing to be strong. And it's kind of a yes. finding that balance. So, yeah, I like that. Ben, thank you so much. I mean, this is like definitely full of tons of, I think we're over an hour, so people are definitely getting their doubles worth of information, but you've just shared so much and I'm going to love just going back when I edit this and listening to it again. And then I always kind of go back and listen to the episodes after a while and hear things, and the show notes page will be full of valuable information. And I'm so glad you reached out to me, and I know our listeners are way the better for it. I mean, you've just inspired people today. It's been a great conversation. So,
oh, thank you so much. It's honestly been my pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. Thanks again for listening, and grow local.